There you go. So I guess from now on, you guys will have to have a warm-up act to make sure that everything is working. Okay. Sort of in the optical, sort of spectroscopy is taken for granted, but I'd like to argue that it was spectroscopy to a certain extent that turned astronomy into astrophysics. For example, I mean, the reason I have this picture up, which seems maybe a little odd, except it looks remarkably, when I bring up the Cassay supernova remnant, it has sort of the same colors in it, in the Akshap picture. But if you were to look at this with just sort of filters, you don't get an appreciation of the physics that's actually happening in fireworks. But if you were to actually look at it with a spectrograph, you would know which sort of chemicals were there and everything, and it would tell you about the physics of what's of pyrotechnics. And what we're now going to be able to observe is the physics at the high energy range in detail, the chemistry even. So this is a big gauntlet that's been thrown down because one of the prime targets for these guys are neutron stars. So I'll just put up a little diagram that's probably familiar to many of you. But the structure of a neutron star, you can kind of, once you can divide it into several parts, the inner core, we could just think about a big question mark there. We're not sure about the equation of state of nuclear matter once you're at densities much higher than the nuclear density. And the center of neutron stars is thought to be composed of material like that. And then outside of this regime, the bulk of the star is a fluid, maybe a superfluid, consisting of neutrons, protons, and electrons for the most part. And then as you go further out, there's a region where you have free neutrons, but the protons are sitting in nuclei. Now, the region that I focus on is this little purple region, this what's white and outside. So the purple region, the neutrons are no longer free, so the heat gets carried along by electrons, which is much less effective than by neutrons. And so after a few hundred years of the star's age, this whole region is thought to be isothermal, and then what we actually see is determined by the temperature of this region, modulated by how well the star is insulated by this purple region, and then the white region, the atmosphere, forms the spectrum. And in the neutron star, the atmosphere might be several lengths of this stick. That's how thick it is. while this region is about the size of a couple football fields. And then out here, this region out here is also important. This region is filled with a strong magnetic field and also a strong gravitational field, which modulates what we see as well. So one thing that's nice about the neutron stars, they have this vast range in density, which allows you to focus on different areas of physics separately. So kind of just to go with that picture, the internals of the star, you have to worry about the nature of materials at densities larger than nuclear. And then as you leave the star, the radiation has to pass through a strongly magnetized vacuum and also in a strong gravitational field. And maybe you're lucky to have a millisecond pulsar as well, so this might be non-trivial. Although I think it's always non-trivial, but it might be more interesting. But it has interesting observational consequences regardless. So if you just look at where neutron stars sit, how big they are, they're an order of 10 kilometers, and we still don't know. These different lines correspond to different potential equations of state for nuclear matter, and we still, it's not certain which of these lines that is actually appropriate, because our terrestrial experience doesn't probe the region that neutron stars probe. And like most degenerate stars, they shrink as they become more massive. This region is an interesting region between here and here, which none of these equation of states visit, which is where a star sits inside its photon orbit. So there you have kind of some interesting relativistic things that can happen. And there's a type of stars that are thought to have a quark core, so ups, down, and strange in the core. If the bulk of a star consists of that, they actually sit in this region. And they're actually bound partially by the strong force. So at least in some regime, they actually get larger as their mass increases, which is kind of amusing. And all of these are still more or less possibilities, you know, for what neutron stars could actually be. So what we need to understand is, given what we're going to observe, what can that tell us about where actual neutron stars sit in this diagram? So, to do that, we have to understand those regions on the diagram that are very thin, the purple, the white, and the black, well, which is the rest of the universe, it's black, but you have to understand how that affects things. In the atmosphere is formed with atoms that are dominated by the magnetic field, so one has to understand how atoms look in strong magnetic fields. As you go to higher densities, what you have is the heat is being conducted by electrons, but the electrons are trapped in effectively a one-dimensional gas. And it's nearly one-dimensional, so you don't have any exact results that you can look at. And this is what will translate what the internal temperature of the star is into a spectrum, or vice versa. This is how theorists always talk, but in a few years we'll have a spectrum, and well, what is the temperature of the star, what is its radius, what is its mass? So, this is for a picture of hydrogen atoms, just to give an idea of the main effects. This is the 1s state and the 2s state of hydrogen. And in a strong, and this is with zero field, and this is with around 5, 10 to the 12 Gauss field, which is typical for neutron stars. And it's to the same scale. So what happens generically is you get two sorts of states in the strong magnetic field. One that ends up, well, they all end up being very compressed along the field direction, but one ends up being compressed in both directions, and they end up being highly bound. And then ones that are less concentrated. It turns out this state in an infinitely strong magnetic field and this state in a zero field have nearly the same energies. So what you can get is transitions between tightly bound states and these high states, which can appear in the soft X-rays, it turns out, even for hydrogen, which is a little bit of a surprise. And generally, in the case where the field or the nucleus is dominating, it's straightforward to obtain solutions. But, for example, neutron star surfaces are thought to maybe be of iron. In that case, both parts are important. And then the other bit of physics that goes into how hot the surface is going down, is how the heat gets conducted out. And this is sort of a schematic diagram of, in the solid state, what happens. You have magnetic field lines threading the surface, and an electron can move freely along the field line, but as it goes in any other direction, it wants to go around the field line. So if the time scale, if the cyclotron frequency is less than the time between scatterings, the magnetic field dominates and you just get conduction more or less along the field. So just on the basis of sort of a classical analysis, you can argue that there's less cross conduction. But another, turns out, more important effect is that actually the electrons can travel along the field further, because the gas is effectively one-dimensional. The reason is this is a degenerate gas. So when an electron scatters, it has to find a state to scatter into. So in a three-dimensional gas, and it's all elastic scattering. So if this is sort of the vector representing the momentum, after an electron scatters, say it's going this direction, it's free to go anywhere in a sphere. So there's a lot of places that might be empty. However, in the strong magnetic field, due to quantum mechanics now, it's restricted to either go along the field, more or less, or against the field. So it won't scatter because it has no place to go after it scatters. So in sufficiently strong fields, the electrons can travel long distances, carry the heat out very effectively along the field. And the actual scatterers are shown in this picture. So here's a nice lattice. And, well, one of our atoms has decided to be something else. So the electron can scatter off that. And also here an atom is displaced out of the lattice, which represents a phonon. These are the two things that they scatter off of in strong in the solid state. And then in the liquid state, the lattice disappears, so an electron really can scatter off any ion. And it turns out it's in the liquid state that actually the liquid bit of the neutron star determines strongly how hot the star is going to be. So you can really reduce the problem to just understanding this problem, electrons scattering off ions. Although to get it precisely, you want to look at both areas. So if you put this together in sort of what's a standard picture of cooling, which means that the center of the star is typically about 100 million degrees after a million years, and it's a billion degrees at 1 year, more or less. That's standard cooling. What happens is you can see as you increase the field, this is a zero field, the star gets brighter when it's young, gets brighter and brighter. And when it's old, what happens is in the strong fields, the photons get out more easily in a strong magnetic field. So in this regime, photons are actually cooling the star. Here, neutrinos are. So out here, the strongly magnetized stars are actually fainter. You can see here, and then here, and then here, and then here. However, one thing that the magnetic field can do on top of that is it might decay. So the neutron star is an extra bit of free energy, which is this strong field. And in sufficiently strong fields, which is this is sort of 10 to the 15, 16 Gauss, this field decay can actually dominate the emission at different times. So here the field decay is actually having a strong effect on the emission. So for this sort of field, probably excluded, but we might have some objects, magnetars, which have fields like this. And if the field decays, they end up being significantly brighter when they're middle-aged, while when they're young, it doesn't make much difference, the field decay. No, this is just T-effective. So it's, okay, sorry. These are iron envelopes. So I'm making a distinction between the atmosphere and the envelope. So the area that's providing the insulation consists of iron. Well, it ends up the conductivity. What you need to do is get the field to move. So this field decay is due to sort of ambipolar diffusion in these strong fields. So it happens ohmically eventually, but you have to push the field out of the core. But well, what happens in a neutron star is you have neutrals. You have a lot of neutrals, i.e. the neutrons. And then you also have the protons and electrons. So you can get a drag. It's an effective resistance. When you pull the field along, the neutrons are kind of lagging. So you can get a drag like that that tends to push the field out of the center of the star. So that's the process that's causing this. The field decay in these pictures.
In the early days, I guess you're saying that neutrinos dominated cooling, are they? But and yet are they affected by the crust, the iron crust, or are they coming from the bulk?
Oh, yeah, they come from the center of the star.
And if why did they? Okay, so in why was the magnetic field important in the early days?
Okay, well, the magnetic field, what it's doing is it doesn't affect strongly what the temperature of the core is, but it's like if you have a house that you set it to 80 degrees and you go outside and measure the infrared radiation coming out, the neutrinos are the thermostat, right, that tells you what the interior temperature is, but depending on how good your insulation is, what we observe is the thermal radiation coming through the surface. So if you have R50, you have less thermal radiation from your house than if you have R15. So the strong magnetic fields, you know, you're reducing the R value of the neutron star's crust.
So in fact, what you're looking at here is the temperature of the crust.
The temperature of the surface. So this is what we're going to observe, is sort of the total flux from the surface. If you were to plot, look at what the core temperatures did, they would kind of track the same line regardless of magnetic field here. And then as you come to this regime, the stronger magnetized objects would drop quicker than the colder, because then what happens is the neutrino cooling isn't very effective any longer. So the actual dominant cooling is through the magnetized crust. So this... Well, it, yes. Well, I mean, it can do several things. I mean, what I'm going to talk about here is how it affects polarized radiation. Well, what happens is, generically, the temperature here, Court, it's giving you energy, you know, several, you know, around a kV or a little bit lower. So you can think of the actual plasma part of the magnetosphere isn't having a strong effect at this high energy. But what is happening is it's strongly magnetized. So there's the actual radiation propagates in a region where you also have to worry about it doesn't just simply propagate. The modes between the two polarization modes in that regime are decoupled by this strongly magnetized in the magnetosphere. So that's the main effect that happens in this regime. You don't have to worry about the plasma itself so much. But I'm using the word magnetosphere because it's a strong magnetic field there. Okay. Yeah. Okay. On this picture, well, what really is happening is, it's kind of a coincidence, but it does. If you think about what is the region of the neutron star that strongly affects the cooling, it's sort of where the electrons are becoming mildly relativistic, okay? So that gives you sort of an energy. Now, if you ask, magnetic field, the cyclotron energy is also mildly relativistic. Yeah, so that's how come in this part, no, it's in the outside that they actually play a role. You can not worry about QED here. Okay, so this picture is standard cooling, which means that the center of the star is thought to consist of just neutrons, protons, electrons, maybe some muons to add in for fun. But if the core, if the very center of the star contains some free quarks or a pion condensate or a kaon condensate, cooling can proceed much more rapidly. And the reason that this happens is if you just have neutrons, protons, and electrons, to actually get any energy out in neutrinos, you have to have two particles slam into each other. And then what happens is you have an energized neutron, let's say. So it's sitting above the Fermi C, and it can decay to a proton, an electron, and a neutrino, and the neutrino goes away. And then that proton will go back into a neutron or wherever. So you get a cycle going. But you need at the start one particle slamming into another. But if you have free quarks, you can kind of run a process just between without worrying about this. You don't need this initial thing happening. So what happens is in young stars, if you have the very core of the star having these extra particles, it can cool faster. So then the center of the star gets colder than the outer bit of the star. And it's all, everything's very hot from the supernova. So the center of the star gets colder. So heat starts flowing into the center, gets radiated as neutrinos, but the envelope and the outer part of the star doesn't know about it. So the star, when it's young, this is 1 year, this is 100 years, the star can just go along here. But eventually this cooling wave reaches the surface of the star, and the star will precipitously drop in its emission. So what's plotted here, this is not actually, this isn't my work, it's by Umeda, a recent paper, is plotted here several objects, but interesting enough is here's this object, Cas A. So this is just looking at the inferred flux effectively from the images that appeared on CNN. We see that Cas A actually, if you look at standard cooling, it would be up here, but it actually shows up down here. So if it's a neutron star, something odd is happening. And it turns out, because Cas A is thought to be about 320 years old, you're very close, you're very sensitive to when this cooling wave pops out of the surface. And it turns out the cooling wave gets trapped up in, I guess it was green on the diagram, the region of the crust that has free neutrons but no... but not free protons. So the other particles are nuclei. So Cas A might provide an important, I mean, there's caveats to this. First of all, but it tells us if Cas A is a neutron star, which we'll see with more analysis, that neutron stars, actually something funny happens to the equation of state, and it also constrains how thick the crust is. Because if the crust were much thicker, the cooling wave would take 1,000 years, not less than 320 years to pop out. So, I'll just bring up the pretty picture from Cas A. Essentially, this conclusion is only from the fact that we see this little guy there. That's all you need to come to that sort of conclusion. But it could be a black hole. So, which is also a nice surprise because it would be the first supernova that we can actually saw and associate with a black hole, if it turns out to be that way. But if you look into further details about either Cas A or any potential neutron star, you find, well, if it's a neutron star, as the star rotates, sometimes the heat is going across the field, sometimes with the field, so you expect the star to vary with time. And since the flux depends on the strength of the magnetic field, you'll also find that out. Now, the spectra are formed in this thin atmosphere, so you can do effectively stellar atmospheres on a neutron star if you want and get also the gravitational redshift, maybe the acceleration and some other things. The atmosphere produces polarized radiation, which propagates through the magnetosphere in a non-trivial way, which actually can tell you what the magnetosphere looks like. So if I have time, I'll go through all of those, but I'll start with the things that are less esoteric. So if you look at, I said back there, oh, you can tell what M over R is just by looking at the variability of the star. So it turns out if you look at, you know, an average star, you always see the half of the star that's facing you. But if you look at, if I were a neutron star, you'd be able to see behind my ears. And if I were a very massive neutron star, you'd get to see the back of my head. And also I would effectively have eyes in the back of my head too. So as you go to more condensed neutron stars, so standard models, have sort of a radius around 10 kilometers. If you were to look at just where you neglect general relativity, you have a sort of variation in the flux here from the, in this unit, 1/2 down to whatever that is, 25. So it varies by a factor as the star rotates, because you're always seeing half the star. As the star becomes more compact, you're seeing the back half of the star. So you're seeing, you effectively, when you're either looking at the star with the pole facing you and one facing away, but the other position isn't like that. You're looking at two poles, both facing you, because the light bends around the back. So just by figuring out what the variability is going to, should be for models and then measuring it, it can tell you where the neutron star sits in this picture. And it turns out you might have stars that don't vary at all as they rotate just because of lensing. And if you look at this picture, there you would find that their spectra don't vary it very much either. So this just plots where, if you look at different regions of the star, how much flux comes from regions of different temperatures. So at some points, you're unlucky that as the star rotates, you're always looking at the sort of same mix of temperatures, even though sometimes you're looking at a pole, or rather, sometimes the pole's facing you, sometimes it's not, but it always looks as if the star is pretty much uniform. Well, they've detected variability. They've looked at the spectra, and they look pretty much thermal, maybe with a little extra bit at high energies. So, but you can't get at anything further. You can't say, first of all, the atmosphere, it could be just a simple black body. It actually, if the crust, if the surface consists of a sort of solid metal, the spectra will be a black body. If the surface has light elements, what will happen is it will look like a black body, but it will be shifted blueward, and you might get a line or two. But sort of the resolution right now isn't enough to say whether there's a line or not. Yeah, they detect things like this. But you can't, we can't say without looking, let's say, in the optical way out here, whether it's sort of on this curve or this curve. And we definitely can't say whether it's these two curves.
What specific time does the purple curve blur?
Well, in the light element atmospheres, the opacity drops very quickly as you go to higher energies. Yeah, exactly. So the opacity drops quickly as you go to higher energy, so you see hotter parts of the atmosphere as you go bluer. Okay, and then if you go, actually, if you go into the optical, this actually ends up being hotter than the optical. So you can actually, by looking in the X-ray and optical, you can sort of constrain that. But right now, it's not enough to determine whether you're on this line, let alone whether you're sort of a iron type atmosphere or a solid surface. Okay. Now, even if the whole surface is the same temperature, it turns out the atmosphere, it will actually make things vary. You get both, just like in regular stellar atmospheres, you get limb darkening. So as you look in one corresponds, that's just sort of the cosine of your viewing angle. So if you're looking straight into the atmosphere versus looking at the edge, you lose a lot of the high energy emission. This is for iron, so you actually can see the lines here, and we should see these lines with, well, they're very soft, so we'll be looking in this region probably. But we should see whether these lines are actually there in the next couple months. Also, what happens is sometimes in the atmosphere you're in a region where the field points towards you or to the side, and that also affects how much emission you get. So even if the volumetric flux coming in the bottom of the atmosphere is the same all over the star. When you actually look at it, it will vary. While on a regular star, you wouldn't have that happening because the atmospheres are symmetric. Okay. Now if we delve deeper into these lines, you can kind of get a simple, an idea of what they can tell us. In neutron stars, just like regular stars, they have collisional broadening and thermal broadening. So the widths of the lines are going to tell you what is the surface gravity and what is that also an independent estimate of the temperature. But you also have to worry about other things. Neutron stars are strongly magnetized. So when an atom moves across the field in the neutron star just due to its thermal motion, what it actually sees is a really strong electric field, which shifts its states. So you'll also get lines that are very asymmetric due to a stark broadening. And also you'd get asymmetries due to the fact that the field changes over the star. So potentially all of these, putting all of these things together is complicated, but they'll all appear in the spectra if we're lucky enough to have neutron stars with a lot of lines. But fortunately, some things that happen are the positions of the lines. As I mentioned earlier, there's sort of two types of states. One, asymptotically look like zero field atoms, and the other type, they kind of nosedive. They get very tightly bound with strong fields. So the distance between, let's say, widely spaced lines depends mainly on the strength of the field. But then if you have sort of two lines in a complex, their actual distance only depends strongly on what the gravitational redshift is of the surface of the star. So the atomic physics kind of might let us have to analyze at least certain properties of the star in a straightforward way, although understanding the broadening in detail is still, the atomic physics even for that is not all complete, because you have to think about atoms in strong magnetic fields and a strong electric field at the same time. I think it's good enough. Yeah, I think they're going to. It depends on whether if you're lucky with iron. I mean, I think this is including everything but this electric stark broadening. So these guys are showing you about how broad they are. Yeah, you also expect rotation to broaden them on top, which I didn't mention there. I think possibly. I can get into that afterwards, but I'm not presenting anything about that. I mean, it turns out that there may be weather effectively on isolated neutron stars, but that's sort of a maybe fifth order effect. I don't know. So just to see how everything goes together, this is a picture of what iron spectra look like in a sort of 10 to the 13 Gauss and 10 to the 12 Gauss. I don't know. No. This is the best we can do now. I would argue, I don't know, as far as I know, the iron in the strong magnetic field with all these states has only been treated by Miller, I'm pretty sure Cole Miller, which became the input for these plots by Raja Gopal. But it's a hard problem. They're going to be some in a sufficiently weak field, the tightly bound states won't be strongly affected by the magnetic field. So you can imagine you'll still get sort of things like the iron K line that might not be shifted very much. However, if you think about states further out in the zero field case, these states, we don't know exactly where they're going to go. and also you have, you know, a lot of electrons. And I don't think iron in zero field is understood in detail, theoretically. So here it might not be as hard as zero field, because you only get sort of one electron in each shell in a magnetic field. So there's less interaction there than in regular atomic physics. But it's sort of supercomputer type of work. I don't know if we'll be able to tell what the field strength is, but we'll probably be able to tell from the width of the lines, maybe be able to separate, you know, what's collisional broadening versus magnetic broadening in these guys, especially for the lines that aren't strongly affected by the magnetic field, which tend to, they do exist even in iron. And if you look at this as an example for helium, which we might believe a little bit better, we might ask, why do we care about helium on neutron stars? Because they've been cooked in the center of a supernova. They'll all be iron. But what can happen is if later on any material falls on the star, maybe from the supernova itself, when it slams into the surface, it's going to break up probably into helium, into alpha particles, or maybe all the way down to protons. So for helium, we can get into the atomic physics a lot. It's a lot more accessible, the calculations actually haven't been done for intense magnetic fields yet, kind of sort of 10 to the 9 Joules, not up to 10 to the 12 or 10 to the 13. Okay, so now all of these things so far, I promised to tell you what the satellites will tell us about. They'll tell us about the spectra in as detailed a way as I've put up on these plots. The satellites are that good. However, the one thing that they won't tell us anything about is how the light. I don't think so. But even SXRP will only tell us about. Okay. There's an instrument that's slated, that's been built for the satellite Spectrum-X Gamma. I think the actual satellite's been pretty much put together, but it's sitting somewhere in the world, and it's supposed to be launched in Russia. So it's unclear when it will get launched, and even when it gets launched, whether it will make it to where we want it to go, rather than looking for polarized X-rays at the bottom of Lake Baikal or something. So, or, you know, sold for parts, I don't know. But the emission from the surface of the star is going to be polarized. For two reasons. Even if the star has no atmosphere, it'll turn out to be slightly polarized just due to QED. But that's a small effect, except for the really strongly magnetized stars. But the atmosphere polarizes the light just because the cross-sections, the main sort of opacity is free-free emission. The cross-section for free-free emission depends on the polarization of the light. So what you expect is, if you were to look at just half the star, you'd observe a lot of polarization because you're looking at sort of a more homogeneous magnetic field. But as you shrink the star, you can see the polarization drops that you expect. So this is the sort of average polarization over the viewed surface of the star. For as you increase the mass of the star for a fixed radius. Also, just a little bit more about Spectrum-X Gamma, that it won't necessarily, even if it does fly, Spectrum-X Gamma is sensitive to the polarization right here, and also at twice that energy, so at 2.6 and 5.2 kV. It's also sensitive over a wide range, but for sort of polarizations of 15%, it wouldn't necessarily pick that up. So even if it does fly, well.
But you do have negative.
Yeah, this is not from mine. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. This is Pavlov's stuff. So I'm not actually sure what this means over here. But it's a nice picture to describe it. Yeah, I think, yeah. So you would expect the flux to be polarized in the optical as well. Yes, but it's sort of, you know, B of 25 or something. Yeah, well, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it might be 5 to 10%. So it's, if you, but at that regime, you have to also worry about the plasma, you know, that it's going to propagate through and whether the plasma is messing up the modes. Okay, and also that emission may also include some, that problem in principle is solvable. And it turns out the polarization will tell you more than M over R, and I'll describe how that's important. And even in the UV or wherever you would observe it, this would happen. As I mentioned earlier, even if there is no atmosphere, the emission will be slightly polarized, which is, this is a tiny percentage. But this percentage is just due to the fact that the index of refraction for a photon in the parallel mode is slightly bigger than for one in the perpendicular mode. So when the black body is formed, there's more phase space available to the parallel photon, so you get a slightly more of them. But you can see this, well, this is sort of a level of optical polarization that you could do if the source were sort of tenth magnitude. But potentially, you know, one day we could measure it. But more importantly, what happens is that in the neutrons, in the magnetosphere, the direction of the field doesn't change over a short distance compared to the size of the photon. And it also, if you think about it, a given photon has two modes, which have different values for the wave number. And that difference, actually, if you were to take that difference between the two modes and multiply it over the typical scale that the field changes size or direction, it's a large number. So what happens is, as a mode travels, polarized radiation travels away from the surface of the star, if the field direction changes, so does the direction of the polarization. And that's what this plot is showing. So, since the number of interest is just delta K times sort of the characteristic radius of the star, you can see that higher frequency radiation, the polarization direction tracks the field longer than for lower frequency radiation. So what you can do is go back and calculate and look at the direction of polarization for, let's say, it works best for the crab net pulsar, actually, because it's strongly magnetized and spinning quickly. You can go back and map what the direction of the field was as a function of radius back to the star, and also what its strengths were. And then if you were to look at it, let's say, in the optical or UV, then you have, well, it's the additional problem or additional thing that you can look at, is that the plasma also induces the same effect. So there you'll be probing a closer region into the star, but possibly in more detail. But unfortunately, we're not going to be looking at polarization in the X-rays anytime soon. There are existing polarization measurements in the X-rays for the CRAB and other satellites, for other pulsars. But we're not going to get this detailed, beautiful data now, just for political reasons. Oh, a few times 10 to the 12 Gauss.
Yes, you're talking.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Okay. You produce, okay, if there's no atmosphere, right, and it's just a black body, this is what could produce polarization. This is a separate effect. We would expect, naively, that the emission from the surface of the crab is polarized, both by, if it has some sort of iron atmosphere, the the flux will depend on polarization. And also, the crab is a radio pulsar, and there's even sort of radio pulsar type emission in very high energies up to the optical. So that all you need for this type of thing where the field drags the polarization vector around is to have a polarization vector. And if it's of order 1 because of something else, you know, the atmosphere or synchrotron radiation, the fact that there's a strong magnetic field allows us to go back and understand what the whole run of field is down to the star if we can measure it with sufficiently high precision over short time scales. So the higher frequency radiation will probe the outside of the magnetosphere. So if we had X-ray stuff at like 5.2 keV, we would have an idea of what the magnetic field is in the crab close to the light cylinder. And then if we were to look at the polarization, let's say with one of these, I don't know what they're called, MAMAs, I guess, in the optical at the crab at very high rate, you know, so be able to split it up. If you were to look at sort of the lag, there'd be a lag between the observed polarization direction between these two, and that lag could give us an idea of what the actual field is close into the crab pulsar. So it would tell us, well, does it drop off as R cubed? Does it drop off as faster? Are there a lot of multipoles down there? And stuff like that. Well, not once you're... The thing that's hard in the optical is you get the QED bit of the vacuum polarization and the plasma part of it are comparable. So there, the modes are quite strange. But if you were to look further blueward, you know, in the UV, the plasma pretty much can be neglected. Except you have to worry when it passes through the cyclotron resonance. That will do something. I'm not going to argue with that. But that might be also easy to understand and pull out. I mean, the one cute thing it does is this process will turn linear polarized light into circularly polarized light. So even when it goes through a resonance, all the resonance does is whip it around in linear polarization, but it's already circularly polarized due to this. So looking at the circular polarization would tell us this, but well, it'll be a long time before we see that in the X-rays. So just to... I've said this, I've described what happens, but here's a picture of what happens for the sort of the crab. As you look at, so this would be sort of, these are two models for the field. Let's say one that follows a Deutsch field and then one that follows a co-rotating dipole. So this is sort of infinitely long wavelength and then into the optical in UV and then X-ray. So you would find that you notice a lag as it gets pulled. Well, no, it's not a lag. It's the opposite of lag. It's a lead. So the polarization remembers. It knows about the field direction further out. So that is a potentially interesting probe of the magnetosphere, just courtesy of QED. But we won't know too much about that for some time. So I hope I've persuaded you, regardless of whether the truth of the specific details of what I said, that it's an exciting time to study the high energy universe. And this is mainly courtesy to people who've worked very hard on getting these satellites together. Neutron stars, essentially, you can pick almost any problem in physics other than biophysics. And put it in the context of neutron stars. Plasma physics is important, atomic physics, solid state physics, strong field general relativity, and also particle physics. Although particle physics in a regime that you don't probe with an accelerator.
Are you sure
not life, it's life, but not as we know it, maybe. but also that astrophysics, I think, really got going, you know, 100, 150 years ago when we started doing serious spectroscopy. And now we're able to do that in the X-rays. So this opens up, you know, optical astrophysics, optical spectroscopy is sort of a range of two in energy, and it told us a whole lot about stars. But now we'll have sort of a factor of 10 in energy that opens up in the high energy regime. So whether you're looking at AGN or neutron stars or galaxy clusters, it's an exciting time. Okay. So any questions further?
Yeah, I was wondering if you could remind us of the sort of status of these various satellites you're talking about. So Chandra was launched just a few months ago or something?
Chandra was launched, I don't know, I think in August,
23rd.
July 23rd, and it's bringing down not, you know, science-grade data, but, you know, data that you can get conclusions from, like this picture. Turns out Cassay was in
that.
No, you like, no, like with Cassay, you can download the actual events. It's not anybody's guaranteed source. So there's about, I don't know, several tens of kiloseconds of Cassay that's either on the web or you can get off the web shortly. However, the telescope hasn't really been checked out yet.
So far, it's working as planned.
I heard something about some problem, but I'm not. I don't know the details of it. What is the problem? Okay. So that would affect the imaging or. Yeah, but if you're running the grating in front of it, it won't make too much of a difference, would it? Oh, of course, yeah. So, I mean, so that's Chandra's up. XMM is, if I brought up the pictures, that would be nice. But XMM is mainly focusing on getting great spectra. And I don't know when that's probably on order of a year from now it's going. Huh? I'm preaching to the choir here, but when is that going? December 10th. And then Astro-E, I mean, all the satellites you've already had to apply for time. Astro-E was just about a month ago to get the time, and I'm not sure when it's being launched. And they're very complimentary. Chandra is going to give us lots of pretty images and pretty good spectra. XMM will probably give us the best spectra over a wide energy range, while Astro-E is going to be the best at higher energies. And it'll effectively produce sort of data cubes of spectra for you. So they're complementary. And then Spectrum-X Gamma, you know, when it gets launched, it'll give us some polarization information.
Can I ask about the state of understanding of the
the thing is, the data in ROSAT isn't really enough because the spectra look very similar at that resolution. Well, what's happened is, like, the one that's, I think there haven't been many that you get in the optical. You can only really observe the nearest two neutron stars, which are 1836 and 0720. And 1836 they haven't seen variability in, so that kind of makes it harder. But 0720, what happens is if you plot the different lines, effectively nothing fits well. So what you do is you know what the flux is in the X-rays. So what you try to do is predict what it is in the optical. So you have some curve here, and then either it's going to be a black body light thing, so something like iron, or it's hydrogen. Well, let's just, we'll put it up there. And this will differ by you know, maybe 5 magnitudes. In the optical, what you would see. However, what's observed, this is for B equals zero hydrogen, and the error bars aren't very large on any of these, but the actual data is there. It's hidden in the middle. So no model fits well right now. So maybe magnetized hydrogen will do this. Maybe there's something missing. Maybe it's something that's like a black body plus magnetospheric emission that's bringing it up. So generically, you can't get a good answer yet. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's vague. I mean, this is, the peak isn't very well measured because you don't have great energy resolution. But you can't, what you can't infer is what the effective temperature is. But you can kind of say, here's the maximum emission. I think it's enough to say that. But it's a shaky business. But especially when you, I mean, but what you're looking at is you're kind of, you get a peak here. But it's not really subtle what you see over here. It's off by a couple magnitudes, off the models, which differ by, you know, another order. So even if you get this wrong, you kind of shake this about, but it's hard to get them to overlap in the optical. It's pretty dramatic.
What accuracy do you expect to get
anymore? Oh, it depends whether nature helps us. There's a whole bunch of ways to get at it. So, well, you can get it from the lines, but then you have to understand the atomic physics. I mean, I don't know if I could really pin down a specific number for you. I mean, probably maybe 20, 10. I think a factor of 2 maybe. I mean, I don't know whether I'd venture to say 20%, 30%. Not precisely, but something, it's not sort of a map or a Planck sort of result, but I think we'd be able to do that well. Oh, yeah, well, the width depends on M over R squared. So if the only thing that was affecting the width, you know, if it were just sort of a homogeneous broadening, you would just have G sub S here.
For what's the expectation
for M?
For M
versus R. Okay. M is thought to be sort of, 1.4 solar masses is sort of canonical. And we really don't know what R is going to be. It could be, it's thought to be around 10.
And then what's the prospect for fitting for
I could bring up the equation of state again. I think the prospects are pretty good to right now we don't know if they even sit. We don't know M over R to the redshift of the surface, let's say, whether it's of order 2.5 or 1.2 or anything like that. So we will be able to know whether the equation of state is very soft or very hard. I don't know if we'll be able to pick exactly between two competing ones. But there's this additional effect that shows up in the young neutron stars, and it also carries through to the older ones, that if the equation of state is sufficiently soft, that there's exotic species in the core, the stars can cool more quickly. So that's another, it probes the equation of state indirectly by telling you that these extra species are involved. So that I think we actually have a hint at already. So for example, with Cas A, if we find that it has variability with a very high Q, you know, a very periodic source, it would be hard to argue that it's not a neutron star. And then we'd have to say, hey, it's a lot colder than we expected, which means that the equation of state is softer than what's canonical. So it's hard for me to give a definite answer because you can get M over R, for example, by looking at the how much of the surface you see, which you trace in polarization and variability. You also get it by looking at the lines, and you also get it by getting an idea of sort of what species are down there. So no one's done sort of a global fitting, you know, to figure out what would happen. Yeah, the thing is, let me just... When you go through when you actually calculate the flux that comes through, what you can constrain is the flux over the surface gravity. So R effectively drops out of that. So that sort of the observed luminosity of the star does what shows up in there, or sort of you can think about L local. There isn't going to end up, it's kind of proportional to M through this. But the R part doesn't show up at all, except when you go to L infinity, you get, you know, 1 plus E to minus 2. So that you actually miss that.
So what's different about bursters? Do you feel much different?
You mean bursting accreting sources?
You get a good handle on the radius of the star.
Yeah, but there the emission isn't coming out through the core, so you have an idea of the flux, while the actual models just tell you flux over surface gravity. So it's flux over surface gravity as a function of core temperature, and we think we know what the core temperature as a function of time depends on the equation of state. So it's just because it's just the nature of the atmosphere is effectively plane parallel, so things go in like that.
Great. So Jeremy's around the rest of the afternoon.
Okay. You're welcome.